the Pre-Raphaelites. They were artists, ahead of their time. Amidst all the drabness of Victorian England, they were determined to shake up society, to rediscover the vivid colours and intense beauty and detail of the medieval world. They made controversial paintings, and they wrote symbolist poetry, and they slept with each other's partners all the time. The Pre-Raphaelites were bored to tears with the dreary rationalism of the Enlightenment. They wanted to go back to the world of mythology. And so it makes perfect sense that Kate Forsyth has been obsessed with the Pre-Raphaelites ever since she bought her first velvet dress from an op shop. Kate's new novel tells the story of the Pre-Raphaelites and their affairs, embedded in the folk tale of Sleeping Beauty. And her new novel is called Beauty in Thorns. Welcome back, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me how you discovered the Pre-Raphaelites as a student.
Well, it was during my first degree and I was desperately poor. I was living out of home, living in one of those horrible student squats. I had no money. I had a mattress on the floor and I had an old suitcase that was my cupboard. And every day I had to decide whether I could afford to eat or catch the bus. And one day I was just walking through Newtown in the city and I passed a poster shop and it had this poster hanging in the window and something about it just caught my eye immediately. I was drawn to it. It showed a beautiful woman, a very strong, very tall woman dressed all in kind of smoky blues and greens and looking very, you know, very sorrowful. And she held in her hand a pomegranate. And in the upper right-hand corner were lines of Italian poetry, and the painting was signed Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And I was at once struck by this painting. I knew that it was a painting of Proserpina, or, you know, better known as Persephone, and this is one of my favourite Greek myths. And I knew I had to have it. The price on the poster was all the money that I had in my wallet, every single cent of it. It seemed that I must have it. And so I went in and I bought it. And as the man in the shop was rolling it up and putting it inside one of those cardboard cylinders, he said, "Yeah, it's a great story, that one. You know, that bloke who painted that picture, he was in love with that woman, you know, the one that he painted, but she was his best friend's wife and they could never be together and that drove him mad."
Wow.
And he died eventually. And I'm there going, poetry, art, love, desire, betrayal, lust, madness, death. It had everything that I loved in a story. And that, for me, was the beginning of my obsession with the Pre-Raphaelites.
Okay, so it was either lunch, bus fare, or Pre-Raphaelite art, and you chose art on this one day.
I chose art. Many other times as well.
This is, as you say, this is a picture of Proserpina, also known as Persephone. Mm. Tell me about the myth of Persephone. How does that story work?
Yes. So Persephone was a goddess of spring. She was a great beauty, full of life and youthful vigour. And one day she was ravished away by Hades and taken to the world of the dead, the underworld. And her mother, who was Demeter, the goddess of the harvest, was bitterly grieved. And she searched everywhere for her daughter but could not find her. And as she searched, weeping and, you know, pierced with anxiety, the world was frozen under the mantle of the very first winter. Everything was dying, nothing was growing, nothing was being born because Persephone, the goddess of spring, was gone from the world. At last Demeter went to Zeus, the king of the gods, and she said, "Help me find my daughter." And so Zeus helped her look, and that was when he saw that Persephone was hidden away in that dark world of the dead, you know, Hades, the underworld. But Persephone had just eaten six seeds of a pomegranate fruit, just six seeds. And Zeus said that in payment for that, she must spend 6 months of every single year in Hades. And so when Persephone is in the world of the dead, all the world is dead. Nothing grows. Everything is frozen and death, you know, full of death. And then when, you know, Persephone awakens once more and is reborn into the world, then the whole world is reborn with her, singing.
So this is how we get the seasons. This is the Greek story of how we get the seasons.
This is the Greek story of how we get the seasons. And, you know, Persephone is such a symbol. She's a symbol of death and rebirth. the constant cycle of the seasons, you know, the constant cycle of time, life and death and rebirth.
One aspect of this story I like very much is that she's just eaten 6 pomegranate seeds, mm-hmm. and that's enough to bind her with a debt that will keep her under the ground for 6 months of the year for all eternity.
It's such a large price to pay for such a small morsel of food. You know, 6 pomegranate seeds you can eat in just in a second, really. And the pomegranate, of course, is such a symbolically weighted fruit as well. It
just, yes, women's sexuality is bound in that
diet.
Yeah,
that's right. The split in the fruit, the painting of Persephone by Dante Gabriel Rossetti shows the fruit split open to show the red seeds inside. And in art, this is called the vulvic split. So it represents, you know, woman's sexuality.
Right. And the look on her face in that painting, she's kind of stricken, isn't she?
She's completely stricken. She knows now that, you know, she has been condemned. She's been cursed to spend a time in this world of cold shadows and this world of death, and she's been banished from the world of life above. It's a terrible, terrible curse that's been laid upon her as punishment for eating just 6 seeds.
Kate, how does this story plug into the story of Sleeping Beauty, which is a folktale you've long loved and been obsessed with, and indeed is the kind of the basis of this new book of yours?
Yes. So Sleeping Beauty has been one of the most powerful fairy tales that I've been interested in all of my life. Many fairy tale scholars call fairy tales degraded myth. And by that, they simply mean that it's myth that has been told and retold and retold till it has lost its mythic power and has become a tale, you know, deep with kind of symbolic meaning, but the religious significance of the story has been camouflaged or veiled or eroded away. I prefer to call them camouflaged myths because often the religious meaning of the tales has been hidden on purpose to protect the story from, you know, the triumph of other cultures that have come in and taken over. So Sleeping Beauty is, of course, about a girl who's cursed to sleep. She's cursed to sleep for 100 years. This is thought to pertain to the 100 days of winter. And when she's asleep, the whole world sleeps with her. Even the flies sleep, even the dog on the hearth sleeps, even the horses in their stalls sleep, even the bees in the roses sleep. Everything is asleep, frozen in time, immobilized. And then it is not until the sleeping princess is awakened again to the world that her whole world is awakened also. So she is a goddess of spring, just like Persephone. And when she comes back to life, when she is reborn, so too is her world and every living thing in it.
So once you had seen this picture of Persephone and seen how it understood how it plugged into this beautiful myth of Sleeping Beauty, how did this become a big thing for you, Kate? And tell me how you found out more about Rossetti's story and why this was important to you.
Well, what happened is I took the poster home and I stuck it up on my wall with blue tack. And it was the first thing I saw every single morning as I woke and the last thing that I saw every night before I went to sleep. And the more I looked at it, the more details I discovered in it, the more echoes and symbols, the more, you know, freighted with meaning it seemed to me. And I pondered over the name Dante Gabriel Rossetti because I'd never heard of him before. Now, you know, I come from a very arty family. You know, we have huge amounts of books on art. I knew so much about, you know, Tiziano and Botticelli and, you know, all the great artists. I had read about them. And I kept wondering, why have I never heard of this incredible artist? He was obviously of the school of Botticelli. He was obviously of the Italian Renaissance. And yet I thought I knew everything about art of that era. And then, of course, about 2 weeks later, I was rummaging around in a secondhand bookstore at a church fete, actually, and I came across a hardback book called Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Painter and Poet. It cost me $17. That was a lot of money when I was a desperately poor university student, only 19 years old, but I bought it. And I went home and I read it. And in the pages of that book, that was when I first discovered the story of you know, Rossetti, of the Pre-Raphaelites, of the extraordinary women that he painted and that he loved, of his sister Christina Rossetti, who is now one of my all-time favorite poets. It was around that time that I began to, as you say, dress like the Pre-Raphaelites with my velvet dresses and my long flowing hair and my beads. And I used to imagine I looked like a Pre-Raphaelite poetess, beautiful, gorgeous clothes. And that is what began it for me. I went on from there, you know, buying, you know, Christina Rossetti's poetry, then buying a biography of her, and then, reading more about William Morris, who was the husband of Jane Morris, who was the model for Persephone, discovering his poetry, his design work, beginning to furnish my house by his famous precept, which was, have nothing in your house that you do not believe to be beautiful or know to be useful. And I've kind of decorated my house on that precept ever since.
Have nothing in your life that you don't believe to
be beautiful and know to be useful.
Wow, that's a pretty good thing to live by.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
It really is quite useful when you're trying to decide, you know, what should be kept and what should be discarded. And as time went on, you know, my knowledge about the Pre-Raphaelites grew and deepened, and I was always interested in them and would buy books about them whenever I saw them. And, you know, time went on, and I did another two degrees. And when I was doing my doctorate on fairy tales, I actually wrote a chapter on William Morris, because my doctorate is on Rapunzel, and I was writing a mythic biography of the maiden in the tower. And so I looked at the story right from the earliest archaeological evidence that we have of maiden in tower stories, all the way up to the Grimms, when the story was what we would, you know, perhaps called, you know, crystallized or codified into the form that people know it now. And then from that point onwards, there were a series of different creative responses to the tale, including poems by Anne Sexton, including, you know, Disney's Tangled. Anyway, William Morris, he was the first. You know, Rapunzel was first published in English in the 1850s, and he wrote an amazing Rapunzel poem almost the same year that it first came out. And so writing, you know, spending months studying William Morris and his poetry again, it just reignited my passion for the Pre-Raphaelites. And I just began to read some of my books over again, even though I had so many other books to read. And then I began to order new books. And, you know, once, you know, kind of brown boxes full of books start arriving on my doorstep, well, you can be pretty sure I'm going to start writing about it pretty soon.
Your own story has a fairy tale side to it as well. I don't know if that's quite the phrase I use, but that has that kind of power to it, insofar as when the first time you came on the show, you told the story about how when you were very little, you were savagely attacked by a dog that kept you in hospital through large stretches of your childhood. This was when you were properly introduced to fairy tales and folk tales that helped you.
Absolutely.
How about sleep? Why Sleeping Beauty? What of particular importance was that for you when you were spending all those months and months and months in hospital having restorative surgery?
Well, Sleeping Beauty is just one of those fairy tales that seemed to me so potent to me as a child. When I was the first savaged by the dog, I was only 2 years and 2 months old, and my mother rushed me to hospital, and I was very badly wounded. I had to have more than 200 stitches. You know, my ear had been almost torn off, and my left eye was very badly damaged. I didn't wake up after the surgery. I was in a coma, and I lay in a coma for weeks and weeks and weeks, almost 7 weeks in actuality. And my mother, as she describes it, because I, of course, don't remember, I was only a baby, I was put on a bed of ice because my fever was so dangerously high. I came down with meningitis, which is inflammation or infection of the meninges, the membrane of the brain, and then that developed into encephalitis, which is an infection of the brain itself. Incredibly dangerous illness, particularly all those years ago when I was a little girl. The doctors wanted to insert a stent into my brain to drain away some of the inflammation and the fluids on the brain. But my mother was a trained nurse. She was actually a matron of a hospital. She has an incredible knowledge of medicine, and she knew that this operation had never been successful. No one had ever survived a stent being drilled into the brain. And she refused to sign the release papers. As she tells it, the doctors went away to try and find a more senior doctor to talk to her and try and convince her that this was the only hope of saving my life. And my mother, she sat beside me, she held my hand, and she said, "Katie, come back. Katie, please come back." And then she leant and she, you know, she kissed me on the forehead. And I woke up, my eyes opened, and, you know, my first words were, "I'm hungry," because I hadn't eaten in 7 weeks. And so that story, I heard my mother tell that story many, many, many times over the years that I was growing up. And I was the miracle child. I was the child that woke up when I was never expected to ever wake again. And that story of being in that kind of cursed sleep, unable to be woken, and then being woken by my mother's kiss, is incredibly powerful and beautiful, I think. And so it became part of my own personal mythology, you could say, and part of my family's mythology. And so, of course, when I was 7 years or so and I first read the story of Sleeping Beauty. Well, I first read the story of Sleeping Beauty when I was in hospital, when I was once again in one of those little narrow white cots, you know, locked away from the world, when I was once again in a kind of prison of pain and fever and loneliness. And so that story just had such profound echoes for me. And even at the age of seven or so, I knew that it was a story that meant a lot to me because of it.
So what were the ideas that brought this group of artists and poets together?
So the original Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood was a secret society of seven brash young men. The youngest was John Everett Millais, and he was only just 19. And the eldest was William Holman Hunt, and he was 21. And they were, most of them were students together at the Royal Academy. And they were, at that time, Victorian art was very artificial. It was very brown. All the painters would actually kind of put a varnish over the top of it to try and make it look as if it was very old and cracked. Their subjects were, you know, the great men of the time, the kings and the generals. It was all extremely grandiose, extremely artificially posed. And I want you to see in your mind's eye all those kind of pictures of, you know, kings on horses, you know, looking very noble. The actual painting style was very loose, and the young men of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood used to call it slosh.
Slosh.
Slosh. They said, slosh, slosh, sloshity, slosh. We've got to get rid of it. Sir Joshua, who was the president of the Royal Academy, they called him Sir Sloshua.
Joshua Reynolds, they called Sir Sloshua.
They did. And they actually met one night in September 1848, and they met at the house of Johnny Millais, and they decided that they were going to form a secret society, and their aim was to kind of rattle the establishment, to go back to the precepts of art of the past, of medieval times and of the High Renaissance. They wanted to return to those clear, bright, luminous colours. They wanted to return to the kind of, you know, delicacy of brushwork, this almost hyper-realism. They wanted to paint from nature as nature really was, and that was one of their abiding precepts. They were actually the first artists in the world to go outside. This is something that we normally associate with the Impressionists, but the Impressionists were a good 20 or 30 years later than the Pre-Raphaelites. And they wanted to be as sincere as they could be. They wanted to paint the picture how it was most likely to have been. And so, for example, among their earliest paintings is a painting of Christ in the carpenter shop.
Oh, I've seen that. Yes. Yeah, it's lovely.
Well, at the time it was considered very shocking because it wasn't at all, you know, dramatized. It was just a normal family in a carpenter's shop working away. There was dirt on the floor and cobwebs in the ceilings, and they were all, you know, quite skinny because they were poor, and it just caused an absolute furor because, of course, most paintings of Christ at that time were holy and were romanticized and were, you know...
He's beautiful, isn't he?
Yeah.
In those other paintings. But this one makes him look like a normal person, doesn't
yes.
it? And Mary more particularly, too.
Exactly. He was criticised. This is a painting by Millais. He was criticised for all his scrawny, ugly-looking people in the painting. But at the time, that was what they wanted to do. They wanted to shock. Now, the term Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, according to William Holman Hunt, he was the one that came up with the term Pre-Raphaelite because he'd been arguing with another student at the academy schools and had said, you know, boldly, that there has been no good art since Raphael. And then the other student said, well, then you're a Pre-Raphaelite, aren't you? As a kind of term of scorn.
Slur, right.
A slur. Yeah. And so he really liked that. And then the word brotherhood came from Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who loved the idea of a kind of secret society.
Yeah.
They actually painted for almost a year the letters PRB, somewhere hidden on their paintings before word got out, and then they ended up not doing it anymore.
For Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood.
Yeah.
For a brotherhood, there were a lot of women there, weren't there?
Well, the original brotherhood were seven young men, but they needed someone to paint. For example, Rossetti, his original models were his sister, Christina, who was then only 17, and his younger brother, William, who was one of the brotherhood, and they painted each other. But they were all drawn to wanting to paint women, you know, because they were drawn to the stories of fairy tales and mythology, you know, goddesses and sirens and mermaids. And so they were always looking for models to paint for them. One of the very first models for the Pre-Raphaelites was Lizzie Siddle. The popular story is that she was discovered in a millinery shop. She certainly did work as a milliner's apprentice, but according to Lizzie Siddle herself, she was the one that went out and found the Pre-Raphaelites because she wanted to be an artist. And so she took her sketches to show Mrs. Deverell, who was the wife of the secretary of the art school. And then when her son, Walter Deverell, heard of this young woman who wanted to be an artist, who had this glorious Titian hair, golden red hair, well, then he approached her and she, you know, she modelled for him. She and Rossetti fell madly in love and they had a very tumultuous relationship that lasted for 11 years, really, where they parted and came back together again and parted again.
She appears as a model in another one of the Pre-Raphaelite artist's paintings, John Meyer's painting of Ophelia. This is one of the most remarkable paintings of this period. You see Ophelia, as in Hamlet's Ophelia, drowning in a river. She sort of looks up. You're not quite sure if she's drowned or about to be drowned. It's not quite clear.
I think she's at the moment of surrender, just as she's right about to sink away underneath the water. There's a kind of shadow pulling her down as her kind of antique wedding dress billows around her. Lizzie Siddle actually posed for that painting in a bathtub full of filthy water drawn from the River Thames. It was January and it was bitterly cold. Snow was falling outside the studio. Millet had painted everything except for the figure of Ophelia over the course of the summer, and he was trying to get this painting finished in time to put it in to be shown at the exhibition, which was always in April, and so he was racing to get this painting finished.
So he got a bathtub full of water from the Thames?
Yes, filthy, cold water.
Ugh. The Thames was filthier then than it is now, too.
It absolutely was, God. You know, typhoid and cholera and everything bobbing around in that water. She lay in that bath, in that antique wedding dress, in that freezing, filthy water for 5 hours without moving. And one by one, the candles and lamps that had been set underneath the bath to try and keep it a little bit warmer, they all blew out. So the water just got colder and colder, and the studio got darker and darker, and Lizzie just lay there, silently suffering, because she came from a desperately poor family. Her brother had died only 2 weeks earlier of consumption, of, you know, tuberculosis, and she needed the money. And if she failed any of these young artists, they would just not ask her to model anymore and she'd have to go back to being a milliner's apprentice. All this new life of art and beauty and poetry, all the high romance of this new life would be taken away from her. And so she lay there and made herself extremely ill.
Yeah, what happened once she got out of the bath after that 5 hours?
She came down with what most people think of as being pneumonia. We know that she was desperately ill because the Siddle family called a doctor. And normally, you know, lower class families have very little money, would do anything not to call a doctor. Mr. Siddle, her father, actually applied to Johnny Millet to pay the doctor's bills, and he did so. And Lizzie's father also tried to sue him, you know, for damages. But that Millais refused to pay. I think Mr. Siddle was, you know, trying to get some easy money. Lizzie was prescribed laudanum, which was a common, panacea that was prescribed to everyone for everything in those days.
What was laudanum?
Laudanum is an opium tincture in alcohol. It's often sweetened with honey and herbs, and it was quite delicious.
Oh, my God. So you'd feel fantastic after taking that?
Certainly for a time. It eases your aches and pains. It would ease your cough. It would help you sleep. You know, if you've had it been, very ill with a feverish type of how hard it is to sleep because you ache all over. And it would have alleviated her anxieties as well. So it wasn't long before Lizzie was addicted, and she was to battle her laudanum addiction for the rest of her life.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
So before we were talking about Millais' painting of Ophelia, that he painted, that eerie painting which he did of Lizzie Siddle as the model lying there, and she had to lie on a bathtub of filthy Thames water for 5 hours that made her ill. Nonetheless, the result is this startling and great work of art, it has to be said.
It is an extraordinary painting, and you need to imagine how it would have been when it was first seen, when it would have glowed out from the walls of the art gallery, surrounded on all sides by kind of brown conventional paintings, and it just glows with this astonishing colour and luminosity. It is now worth about $50 million, and one of the reasons why it is so famous is because there are symbols in the painting that seem to forebode what would happen to its model, the young woman who was posing as Ophelia, Lizzie Siddle. By her hand floats a red poppy, which is the flower from which opium is extracted and is the key ingredient in laudanum to which Lizzie had become addicted.
But only after the painting was done.
And in the foliage on the banks of the river, Millais actually painted a skull. Once you have seen the skull, you can't unsee it. It's so obvious. It's kind of hidden in light and shadows amongst the leaves. But this image of mortality and death in a painting of a young woman who was then only 19 years old, but who would eventually die such a tragic death.
So what impact did this painting have then when it was put on show?
Well, it caused an absolute sensation. They had to hire a policeman to keep the crowds back. The lines of people who wanted to see this painting just snaked all the way through the galleries of the Royal Academy and outside. And it made John Everett Millais, the painter, an overnight sensation. And he actually sold that painting for the most amount of money he'd ever earned for a painting. And Lizzie Siddle's life was changed as well.
Because she was with Dante Gabriel Rossetti, another one of the pre-Raphaelite paintings.
Yes.
She was his muse and also his mistress. How did that relationship evolve?
Well, it was quite a problematic relationship because Lizzie really gave up everything in order to be with him. She gave up any chance of having a conventional marriage or a conventional life. You know, the moment she began to model for these artists, her reputation was destroyed. She wanted to paint herself, and she wrote poetry also. And she studied with Rossetti, tried to learn the craft, and worked on her own paintings. The whole time they had this very on-again and off-again relationship. Lizzie's laudanum addiction led, I believe, to an eating disorder. A laudanum suppresses the appetite. And, you know, Lizzie was a very highly strung and ethereal creature anyway. You can see, you know, Rossetti drew and painted her obsessively over the course of the next 5 or 6 years, and you can see her gradually dwindle away till she is absolutely skeletal and has this haunted expression on her face.
As you say, she was very pale-skinned, had that kind of amazing golden red hair and blue eyes, and that pale stare of hers, and so she just kind of fades away a bit, does she?
Yeah, there are endless accounts in the letters and diaries of the Pre-Raphaelite circle. So the other, you know, the many other artists and poets in the circle about, Ford Madox Brown describes her. She's thinner and more ragged and more death-like than ever, for example. So her laudanum addiction and her eating disorder made her ill. Everyone thought that she had consumption, because the number one symptom of tuberculosis was this kind of wasting away. But countless doctors could find no sign of tuberculosis in her. Anorexia nervosa had not yet been diagnosed. In fact, it would not be named or identified till 6 years after Lizzie's death. And so at the time, no one understood that this was a psychological disorder.
What was the final straw for her?
Well, what happened is that eventually Rossetti went to Oxford with his two young acolytes, William Morris and Edward Burne-Jones, and they met a striking young woman down there called Jane Burden. She was 6 foot tall. She had extremely long limbs, long fingers, a mass of tightly crinkled black hair. And Rossetti fell in love with her, or he at least had a fling with her. Lizzie heard about it. She heard the gossip, and she wrote to him and summoned him back to her side. And Jenny was left bereft. She ended up marrying William Morris, who was then one of the richest young men in the world. A year after William Morris married Janie, Gabriel married Lizzie. She was at that point on the verge of death, and he said to her, if you will just get well, if you can just get well enough to walk to the church, I will marry you. And so she recovered enough that she could walk to the church, and they were married. And less than a month later, Edward Burne-Jones married his childhood sweetheart, Georgie MacDonald. So you have these three couples, all artists, all great friends. They were painting together. They spent their weekends at William Morris's country house, which was called Red House in Kent. They painted murals on the walls. They had feasts. They played hide and seek in this massive house. And everything was very joyous and content for a while. But then both Janie Morris and Lizzie Siddle, who was then Lizzie Rossetti, fell pregnant. Janie Morris had a little girl called Jenny, but a month later, Lizzie's daughter was born dead. She had a stillborn daughter, and this just broke her heart and broke her mind.
What do you mean by broke her mind?
A few days after having given birth to a stillborn child, and Ned and Georgie Burne-Jones went to visit her, and they found her rocking an empty cradle and singing a lullaby to a child that was not there. She increased her laudanum dosages. She was sent to stay at Red House, but she couldn't bear being around Janie Morris, who had this beautiful little baby girl. So she ran away and, you know, found her way back to their apartment in London. As time went on, she went deeper and deeper into postnatal depression and deeper into laudanum addiction. And almost a year after her baby had been born dead, Lizzie had an overdose of laudanum and died.
How grief-stricken was Rossetti at the funeral?
He was utterly distraught. He could not believe that Lizzie had died. He was riven with guilt because he feared that she had taken the laudanum on purpose, even though the inquest had found it an accidental death. He put in Lizzie's coffin his only manuscript of poems, a handwritten manuscript of poems. Every poem that he'd ever written was buried with Lizzie. And then every night he saw her ghost standing at the end of her bed, staring at him with his great reproachful eyes. He began to go to seances. He began to conduct seances, trying to reach Lizzie, trying to speak to her and know that she was happy, that all was well. He became a recluse. He filled his house with art and curios. He had a bizarre collection of animals, including a wombat, which he called Topsy after William Morris. He had peacocks. He never went out during the day and only went out at night. He was suffering terribly from insomnia and nightmares, so he began to take Clorol, which is like a Mickey Finn. He would take it in whiskey. It's what a Mickey Finn is now, Clorol hydrate in whiskey. And he just sank deeper and deeper and deeper into despair.
What about that poetry? How long did that poetry lay in that coffin of Lizzie Siddle's?
So 7 years after Lizzie Siddle had been buried, Rossetti had her grave exhumed and her coffin brought up and the manuscript of poems,
dear God,
retrieved.
Wow. And
he had to do it secretly. He had to get a special order. It was done at night so that no one would know. Lizzie was buried in Highgate Cemetery, so I want you to imagine that that vast Victorian cemetery at night with mist and the grave diggers digging up the coffin. And then he had to transcribe every single poem, you know, by hand again. He said that the smell lingered in his hands and on his skin and in his hair for months and months afterwards.
So these poems had been in the coffin next to the decaying corpse of his wife.
There were great wormholes right through them. Only three pages have remained there in the British Library, and you can see the decayed edges and the wormholes through the lines of poetry.
You've seen this manuscript?
I have, yes. I've seen a facsimile of them. The British Library have them.
This is about as gothic as you can possibly get in this lifetime, surely.
I know. It's an extraordinary story. And Rossetti would come to be as racked with guilt about that act as he was about the death of his wife.
Were the poems any good?
Well, he is actually a wonderful poet. I read all of his poetry while I was writing Beauty and Thorns, and I cannot believe that he is not as revered as Tennyson or Browning or any other of the great Victorian poets. They're very passionate, they're very sensuous, they're full of rich imagery, they're really quite powerful.
This is all of a piece with many of the poems and paintings of the Pre-Raphaelites. They're very beautifully rendered. There's great intense beauty, but there's also a lot of languor in them and a lot of kind of sensuality, but also a sensuality that's right on the edge of death at the same time. These must have been so controversial in their
time. They were so controversial. The poems were actually published to great acclaim, which made Rossetti very pleased and proud. Around that time, he had actually had resumed his affair with Janie Morris, who was the wife of his best friend. And he drew and painted Janie as obsessively as he'd ever drawn Lizzie. In about 1871, William Morris rented a house on the banks of the River Thames, and he left Janie and Rossetti there together to have a sort of enchanted summer of love, and he went off.
Hang on. He left his wife and Rossetti there to have an affair in the house that he knowingly
hired the house for them deep in the country, away from the prying eyes of London, away from the scandal mongers. And then he went travelling off to Iceland, leaving his wife and his mentor and best friend to have an affair, to spend the whole summer together, also with Janie's two young daughters, Jenny and May. They had the most enchanted summer, and during that summer, Rossetti wrote some of the most exquisite love poetry ever written. Now, he wrote them in a leather notebook and gave it to Janie at the end of that summer. It's now in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and I've actually read them. I had it brought up from the special collections, and it brought me to tears. It really did. These poems of longing and yearning and passion and desire and kind of almost a forbidden love. When they went back to London, word had, in Rossetti's own words, oozed out about the exhumation and where the poems that he had published came from. And it caused an unbelievable scandal. And it just went on and on. All the newspapers were reporting on it, commenting on it. They were all accusing Rossetti of this kind of, exactly what you said, this kind of, deathly languor and what they call this kind of, loathsome sensuality, this repulsive eroticism in his poems.
See, this is the opposite of what England wanted out of its culture at the time, isn't it? It was a high empire here. This is, they want bracing cold water. They want upright men and women ready to go out and conquer lesser people in the name of the British Empire.
This was at the height of the Victorian era. This was the era when they used to put piano legs, dress them, certainly because, legs were too
rude, too sexy.
Too sexy to be mentioned. They used to put little skirts around their piano legs. So you can just imagine what they thought of this story of lust and betrayal. Anyway, Rossetti was driven quite mad. He had a psychotic break and was whisked away into the country by his friends. They would not let him see Janie or let her write to him. And they kept them apart for about 9 months until Rossetti said to him, "The only thing in this world that I want is Janie. Let me see her." And so they were reunited, but Rossetti was a broken man. He was paranoid. He was addicted to chloral. and he was an alcoholic, and he actually tried to commit suicide with laudanum, the same drug that had killed his wife. And so Janie was unable to help him, and fearing for her own daughters, she broke off their affair, which had actually now lasted for many years. And she returned to William Morris, and he took her back, and they resumed their marriage.
What was that marriage like? Was it more of a state of companionship rather than sort of erotic attraction at this point, given the time she'd spent with
Rossetti? I think it was always a marriage of companionship. I always think it was a marriage of convenience. She was a very poor slum girl that had been discovered in a theatre in Oxford, plucked from obscurity, made the most famous face of the age. She had been in love with Rossetti at the age of 17, but he'd gone back to Lizzie, and so she had married William Morris. She really had no choice, because if a poor slum girl is proposed to by one of the richest young men in Victorian England, well, it was almost impossible to refuse. He worshipped her, but he was a fascinating man. He was a suffragette. He was a socialist. He's actually one of the founders of the first Socialist Party in the UK. He believed that Janie was the mistress of her own body and the mistress of her own fate. And just because she was married to him did not give him the right to tell her what she had to do with her body. He said a marriage like that was akin to prostitution, and he would have no part of it. And that was why, even though he was hurt and betrayed by this covert affair, he would not force himself upon Janie ever if she did not want him. And that was his overriding philosophical principle.
And there's a story here of Sleeping Beauty as well, and this brings me to another one of the artists, Edward Burne-Jones, who was an acolyte of Rossetti's. Tell me about the story of how he became an artist.
Edward Burne-Jones was born to a poor family in Birmingham. His mother died when he was only 6 days old, and his father was absolutely gutted with grief. Edward Burne-Jones grew up in this cold, dark, grief-stricken house, ignored by his father. The only time his father paid him any attention was on Sunday, when they walked together to his mother's grave and knelt there, and his father wept. That was the only contact that he had with his father. So he had this preternatural fear of death that shadowed all of his life. His only comfort was drawing, and he was known for his impish and delightful caricatures of all the teachers and the pastors. And, you know, at school he used to draw pictures of all the teachers that made all the other boys laugh because they were so mischievous. He went to Oxford University to become a pastor, and on his first day, when he was actually sitting his entrance exams, he met William Morris. They were sitting side by side, and the two of them became best friends from that moment on, and their friendship endured everything that came afterwards. They were halfway through their degree when William and Edward decided that they had to leave this preordained life that had been laid out for them, you know, of going into the church and becoming ministers, that they had to pursue their true dreams of art. And so they quit university. And, I mean, William Morris came from a very wealthy family. His father had actually been one of the founding members of the biggest copper mine in the UK, in Devon. And he'd inherited a fortune. But Edward Burne-Jones was absolutely impoverished. But he left Oxford and he went to London. And he went to seek out the man that best exemplified for him everything that he loved about art. And that man was Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And he managed to effect a meeting, and he became Rossetti's most adoring disciple. And Rossetti began to give him lessons and mentored him, and he began a life of art.
Like his mentor, he had complicated relationships with his muses and his models.
He did.
One of his models was a woman named Maria Zambacco. Now, tell me about her.
Well, Maria Zambacco was a sculptress, so an artist in her own right. And she was part of an extremely wealthy colony of Greek expatriates who had left Greece because of the troubles in that land and come to England. And they were great merchants, and they were very, very rich. Maria Zambacco wanted to be part of this world of art, and she wanted to be a part of that kind of pre-Raphaelite circle. And so she sought out Edward Burne-Jones, and her mother, Maria Zambacco, actually paid Edward Burne-Jones to paint her, and they fell immediately into a very passionate, you know, and dangerous liaison. Maria Zambacco was extremely passionate, extremely beautiful, and extremely unstable. So Edward Burne-Jones was then married to his childhood sweetheart, Georgie MacDonald, and they had a son called Philip, or Pip, and then they had just recently had a daughter as well, Margaret, or called Margot. And this affair became extremely scandalous because he painted her and nobody else, Maria Zambacco, I mean. And then he exhibited these extremely erotic and flagrant portraits of her. And one in particular caused an absolute furor because it was Maria Zambacco as Phyllis and himself as Demophoon. This is another Greek myth, and it's a story of a young woman who's turned into an almond tree when her lover forsakes her. And then the lover returns and is overwhelmed with regret that he had caused her death. And she comes back to life and she seeks to embrace him. The young man was painted as a full frontal nude. And this was the first time that a nude had ever been shown on the walls of the Royal Academy. Usually there was a nice little leaf or a little flowing bit of fabric or, you know, a well-placed branch, or their body was turned in such a way that you could see nothing. But no, Edward Burne-Jones painted a male nude for the first time. And the Royal Academy refused to hang it. They said that he was allowed to hang it if he would disguise the private parts with some chalk. And Edward Burne-Jones refused very angrily, took his painting back and never exhibited with them again. So it caused a massive, massive scandal, and his marriage to Georgie came under enormous strain. He ended up breaking things off with Maria Zambacco and going back to his wife, mainly because of his love for his children and particularly his daughter Margaret, who was then just a baby. And Maria Zambacco tried to commit suicide by flinging herself into Regent's Canal on a cold winter's night after drinking laudanum. She flung herself into the canal right outside Robert Browning's house, and so he heard the commotion and called the police, and Robert Browning ended up escorting Edward Burne-Jones home again. And this scandal, we just went on and on and on. And in the end, Edward Burne-Jones really retreated from society for quite a long time until the scandal died away and was replaced with other scandals of the Pre-Raphaelites.
There's a lot of beautiful painting and poetry that comes from this move. Mm. But, oh, my God, all the fallout and the addiction, the people flinging themselves into frozen canals in the middle of the night. Mm. What do you make of all that and the price that was paid for that?
Well, I think that the Pre-Raphaelites wanted to change the world. I think that they believed that they had the right to live freely, to love freely, to paint what they wanted. They were determined to escape from the kind of stultifying pressure of the Victorian art establishment. They drew around them this extraordinary group of women who were artists and poets in their own right. But the thing was, it was still mid-Victorian times, and our society was not yet ready for free love.
No, they kind of anticipated the modern world in a lot of ways, didn't they?
They absolutely did. They became extremely popular again during the 60s because their whole aesthetic and their whole philosophy was, you know, so chimed with that of you know, the flower children.
Mm. And back to nature, back to the earth.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of stuff, yeah. You know, and I think that they're very popular again now for exactly the same reasons. I think they were broken by the society in which they lived. They were broken by the fact that it was just not considered seemly to have affairs with your best friend's wife, to allow your wife to live with her lover, to paint these passionate depictions of love and desire at a time when such things were hidden tightly behind curtains and corsets and all these other things. What fascinates us about their lives is just how passionate they were and how high a cost they paid for that passion.
Edward Burne-Jones's wife put together a memoir after he died. Mm-hmm. And right at the front of your book, you've got a really lovely quote from her. I'd just love you to read this, Kate.
It is beautiful. So it begins, "I wish it were possible to explain the impression made upon me as a young girl, whose experience so far had been quite remote from art, by sudden and close intercourse with those to whom it was the breath of life. The only approach I can make to describing it is by saying that I felt in the presence of a new religion. The love of beauty did not seem to me unbalanced, but as if it included the whole world and raised the point from which they regarded everything. Human beauty especially was in a way sacred to them, I thought, and of this I received confirmation quite lately from a lady. I never saw such men, she said. It was being in a new world to be with them. I sat to them and was with them, and they were different to everyone else I ever saw, and I was a holy thing to them.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's been so lovely to have you back and to tell the story of the pre-Raphaelite.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Kate Forsyth's new novel is called Beauty in Thorns. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.